Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Chocolates are sweet, but they don't last long. Flowers are pretty, and then they're gone. So this Mother's Day, why not give your mum the gift that keeps on giving with Ancestry DNA? Ancestry DNA is on sale now for $99, a saving of $30. Ancestry DNA won't just tell your mum where her ancestors are from, it can also pinpoint the specific regions within those countries, connecting mum to the places where her story started. Ancestry DNA lets us look back across centuries to see where her family lived and where they moved. Combined with Ancestry's massive database of official records, this can open up fascinating migration stories. Who knows? Give your mum Ancestry DNA this Mother's Day and she might even discover living relatives. I know it's possible because it happened for me. Ancestry DNA is safe, easy to use, and completely private. When your mum gets the kit, she just sends back a small saliva sample using the prepaid postal box provided. In a few weeks, she'll receive an email with the links to her results. From there, your mother has control of the data and how she uses it. There could be more to your mum's story. Piece it together with Ancestry DNA, now on sale. Terms apply. Forgotten Australia is written and produced by me, Michael Adams, in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, on land traditionally owned by the Darug and Gundungurra people. I pay my respect to Aboriginal elders, past and present. Every episode of Forgotten Australia is the result of weeks or even months of research, writing, recording and production. So, until mid-May, I'm working on new episodes. For your listening pleasure, and in line with this season's theme of murders that shocked Australia, I'm re-releasing two of my favourite three-parters dealing with very bad men who left trails of death and destruction in their wakes. If you're an Apple or Patreon supporter, you'll have full, immediate, and ad-free access to all instalments. This episode includes graphic descriptions of violence and references to mental illness and to suicide. Listener discretion is advised. It's 6 in the morning, Thursday the 2nd of April, 1936, and at Brisbane Central Railway Station, the overnight mail train from Bundaberg is puffing into platform number 1. Brakes shriek, steam hisses, carriages shudder and then settle. Doors are thrown open, passengers stepping out into the autumn morning, and suitcases and sacks of mail are unloaded from two vans behind the locomotive. Equipment porter Arthur Shaw approaches the first class sleeping carriage, which is the next car along. Unlike other coaches, which are hives of departing activity, car 997 is quiet and closed. The doors are shut. The sun shutters are still drawn. No one's yet emerged. But that's no reason for suspicion. Passengers may simply have gotten off further up the line. But it's Arthur's job to collect any used linen from the sleeping berths. He opens the carriage's rear door and steps inside. Arthur takes off his hat and his coat in preparation for getting to work. Past a vestibule, off which is the gents' lavatory, a conductor's chair and a baggage rack on one side and wash basins on the other, the door to the interior of the carriage is closed. Arthur opens it and steps inside. It's dark, with Brisbane's dawn light filtering around sun shutters and drawn compartment berth curtains. But it's not so dark that Arthur doesn't immediately see that something's very wrong. A man lays slumped in the corridor at the middle of the carriage. Arthur hastens to him. He knows this man. It's conductor Tom Boys. He's on his side in a pool of blood, legs spread-eagled towards the engine end of the carriage. The conductor's forehead is horrifically lacerated. His face is bruised and bloody, and part of his skull appears to be fractured. Porter Arthur Shaw runs from the carriage and shouts to another worker to get the police, because there's been a murder. What Arthur doesn't know is that in his panic and horror, he hasn't yet seen the worst of what awaits deeper in sleeper car 997. I'm Michael Adams, and this is the first part of the three-part Forgotten Australia episode, Nightmare on the Night Train. This episode's been made with extensive reference to archival newspapers found at the National Library of Australia's Trove database, from records at the Public Record Office of Victoria and the National Archives of Australia, and from Family, Government and Police Gazette information found at ancestry.com.au. And thanks to contributions from Patreon supporters, I was also able to access a digitised murder file held by the Queensland State Archives. Parts 2 and 3 of this episode will be released next week, but if you'd like to hear them now, ad-free, they're available for supporters for the price of half a cup of coffee a month. To support the show, go to patreon.com/forgottenaustralia, and this link's also in your show notes. Supporters get early ad-free access to episodes, bonus shows, and other goodies, including a show shout-out. So, a big thank you to recent supporters DB and Vicky Pierre Humbert. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Brisbane's Central Railway Station was a hub of activity just after dawn on Thursday the 2nd of April 1936. Hundreds of passengers were getting off the Bundaberg train, and other people were coming and going on suburban services. Rail and postal workers were buzzing this way and that. But the most urgent man in uniform was a Constable Banks, as he ran to get Police Sergeant George Beale of Roma Street Police Station, who was standing on duty outside the station. The constable had been summoned by the station master. An equipment porter was saying there'd been a murder on the mail train. Sergeant Beale and Constable Banks hurried for Platform 1. There, they were met by the station master and the equipment porter, Arthur Shaw. By now, Arthur and another worker had been back inside the carriage, and what they had to report was unbelievable. There was another body in the sleeping car, a passenger in a berth. Sergeant Beale and the men entered the coach from the rear door. They went past the vestibule area and past empty berth 20 on their left and empty berth 18 opposite on their right. What they saw behind the curtain of berth 16 on their left was sickening. A man in his pyjamas, head pulped on his bloody pillow, the blanket soaked in blood with more gore spattered across the compartment. The man was dead. Sergeant Beale went to the conductor on the floor. He had shocking head injuries, but he was alive, if unconscious. The sergeant told the constable to go get ambulance men and a doctor. Then came a chilling noise. Sergeant Beale would recall, quote, "I heard a gurgling sound further up in the carriage." Standing up, Sergeant Beale carefully stepped over the conductor and walked past two empty berths left and right. There, behind the curtains of the next compartment, number 8, was another man, bloodied and pulverised in his bunk. Ambulance officer Donald Smith and his offsider arrived with stretchers. A quick check confirmed the man in berth 16 was dead. His head had been caved in by crisscross fractures that had exposed his skull. With the help of police, the ambulance men got conductor Tom Boyes onto a stretcher. He had head lacerations, a fractured skull, a contusion over one eye and another on the back of his neck, but he might live. The man in berth 8 was next to be attended to. It was amazing that he was still breathing. He'd suffered multiple penetrating head wounds, numerous skull fractures, and parts of his broken cranium were also visible. The ambulance men got him onto a stretcher and off the train. Soon their ambulance was screaming away from the railway station. It reached Brisbane Hospital around 6:30 a.m. Attendants rushed the victims inside. But the more seriously injured man died within minutes. Conductor Tom Boyes was battling for his life in hospital as the news spread through Brisbane. There'd been a nightmare on the night train. Two men murdered. A third might not make it. The city faced the terrifying realisation that there was a maniac on the loose. As the shockwave spread, police descended on Central's platform number 1. The first things they established, from luggage and ticketing information, were the identities of the dead men. They were Harold Spearing, who died in his bunk in berth 16, and Michael Frank Costello, who'd been taken from berth 8 only to succumb to his injuries. By around 7:30, some 24 detectives and uniformed men were on the case. They immediately searched the train's other 9 carriages for the murder weapon or any other evidence. Both of the men had joined the first-class carriage at Maryborough at around 10 the previous evening. According to the doctor who officially pronounced Spearing dead, he'd been killed around 5 a.m. That was just before the train reached Petrie, about 15 miles north of Brisbane. Police and railway officials all up the line were alerted to what had happened, and investigations began into whether anyone else had gotten on or off this carriage, where and when. But from the look of car 997, it seems Spearing and Costello had been the only two passengers booked. None of the linen on the other bunks had been slept in. That said, it did look like someone had sat on the bed in berth 10. Detectives enlisted Brisbane radio stations to ask the public for assistance. Anyone who'd been at Central Station that morning or had been on the train should come forward if they'd seen or heard anything suspicious. At first, police investigated carriage 997 in situ at Platform 1, but it was highly visible to the public and not easy to access, so the coach was shunted onto a line between the number 3 and number 4 platforms. But there wasn't a lot of light there, and trains kept pulling in on either side, so the carriage had to be moved again to Platform 7. Even there, uniformed police had to keep back a steadily growing crowd. Commuters gathered on ramps and an overhead bridge, anywhere they could get a look at this investigation as it unfolded. Reporters had also descended. This was hold the front page stuff for the afternoon papers, the Daily Standard and Telegraph. When Harold Spearing's sheet-covered body was brought off the carriage on a stretcher to be loaded into an ambulance, news photographers were on hand to capture this grim moment. Inside the carriage, police tried to reconstruct the crime. The violence had been extreme. Spearing had been hit 13 times. Costello had suffered a dozen blows. Both men had defensive injuries to their hands. They'd tried to ward off the blows before being battered to death. There was blood everywhere. There was a big pool of it in the corridor near Spearing. Costello's blood loss had been so extreme it had seeped through the floorboards and onto the underside of the train. Conductor boys had also been hit repeatedly. Even though this slaughterhouse seemed the work of some demon's diabolical savagery, it appeared to have been perpetrated by a panicking petty thief who'd been caught in the act of pilfering from passengers. Spearing's money was gone. His luggage had been removed from beneath his berth, and some of his belongings were strewn around in the blood. His shocked and suddenly widowed wife Cecilia was to confirm he was missing a watch and chain and a leather attaché case. Also missing, a felt hat, a coat and a pair of matching trousers. But the vest that completed Spearing's three-piece suit was still in his suitcase. Costello was known to travel with a considerable amount of cash, and this money was gone, but his baggage hadn't been interfered with. Conductor boys hadn't been robbed of the little money he had in his pockets. Oddly, what was missing from his seat at the rear of the carriage was the diagram he kept of which passengers were sleeping in which berths. Despite their extensive search of the train, police didn't find the murder weapon. From the type of wounds, they at first thought the killer had wielded a tomahawk. That was then replaced with the idea it had been some sort of blunt instrument. In those first few hours, from information about the rail service and the victims, the police formulated a theory of what had happened. Train 112A, as the service was officially known, had departed from Rockhampton at 12:30 in the afternoon on Wednesday, the 1st of April. It reached Bundaberg at 8:30 that night. After departing, a train attendant made up the bunks in the first-class sleeping car 997. Five passengers had been booked to join at Murrayborough just after 10 p.m. Further bunks would be prepared also in case other people bought sleeper tickets at stops down the line. But at Murrayborough, there were three no-shows. These men, who'd been attached to the Land Court, had finished their business early and returned to Brisbane yesterday. So there were only two first-class sleeper passengers, Harold Spearing and Michael Frank Costello. Conductor Tom Boys showed them to their berths. Number 16 for Spearing, number 8 for Costello. Then he said his goodnights. There's a chance that these two passengers knew each other a little due to their shared work history. Harold Spearing, aged 36, was a promising engineer with the Postmaster General's Department. Though young, he'd already been with the PMG for 20 years. Harold had spent the past few days repairing the cable between Yarangan and Woody Island. To do this work, he'd taken a leather attaché case marked PMG that contained his tools. On the night of the 1st of April, he was headed back to his home at Rainworth in Brisbane, which he shared with his wife and their 3-year-old daughter and 2-year-old son. Michael Costello, known by his middle name Frank, was 33, and he was a prominent man in Innisfail in the far north of the state. He'd started his working life in 1918 in the PMG at Murrayborough as a telegraph messenger. In 1920, he'd been transferred to Brisbane to work in the accounts department, so there was a chance he knew Harold Spearing. Frank had worked for the PMG until the following year when he'd resigned and moved to Fiji, getting experience in the sugarcane industry. About a decade ago, he'd moved back to Australia and to Innisfail and worked as an accountant for sugar companies. Frank Costello had a lot of Innisfail feathers in his cap. He was secretary of the Show Society and the local cinema, a leading member of the Chamber of Commerce and treasurer of the town's hospital. But his most important role was as secretary of the local branch of the Australian Sugar Producers Association. Last week, as he had for many years, Frank had attended the ASPA's annual conference in Brisbane. When it was over, as was his habit, he'd gone up to Murrayborough to visit his elderly mother. Frank was going to get home to Innisfail via the coastal steamer Orungle, which left Brisbane on Thursday. He'd planned to get the train yesterday, but he'd slept in and missed it. Luckily, he'd been able to get this night train, which meant he'd still make the ship. Then he'd be up the coast home to be reunited with his wife Violet and their 4 little sons, aged from 6 to 1. Whether Harold Spearing and Frank Costello were old acquaintances or strangers, it's likely they exchanged pleasantries before they retired to their compartments, drew the curtains, and settled into their bunks. The rocking and rattling of the train as it crossed the inky Queensland countryside would have been lulling. Every so often, the service stopped at country stations as it made its way to Dawn and to Brisbane. While passengers slumbered in sleeping and sitting cars, conductor Tom Boys was hard at work ensuring folks got on and off safely at these night stops. Tom was 57. In the early 1900s, he'd worked as a storeman. In 1913, as Spearing and Costello would do in a few years, he'd worked briefly as an assistant with the PMG. But 1913 was the year, at the ripe old age of 35, that Tom Boys found the 2 R's that would change his life. The first R was Rachel Weaver, the 22-year-old woman that he married. Both of Rachel's parents were dead, as were Tom's. And as they weren't to have children, they'd be everything to each other. The second R that changed Tom's life in 1913 was the railways. He joined as a porter that year and worked his way up. For nearly a quarter of a century, he'd served tens of thousands of ordinary passengers. There'd been a few extraordinary travellers too, in the form of state governors and state ministers. But Tom's cherished memory was looking after Prime Minister Stanley Bruce on his special train when he visited the state in the 1920s. When the PM service reached the New South Wales border and Mr. Bruce was to depart, he'd asked, "Where's Tom?" When the conductor was brought to him, the Prime Minister gave him not only his thanks but said, "Here, my friend," and handed over a tip. When Tom looked at the note, he couldn't believe it. £10. Thinking the PM had made a mistake, Tom queried his people, but he was told that Mr. Bruce had wanted to be generous. The great man had so enjoyed his company and service, he even subsequently wrote a letter praising Tom. There weren't any such luminaries on tonight's train to Brisbane, but it didn't matter to Tom. It was the conductor's job to look after everyone equally. By 5:10 in the morning, the train was pulling out of Petrie. Tom had been seen on the platform by a railway guard. The conductor had waved that it was all clear and called out, "All right." The train's driver and fireman told police it was Tom's routine to enter the first-class sleeper after the train left Petrie. This was so he could wake up passengers and they'd have plenty of time to get dressed and wash up before arriving at Central. The police believed the killer had already been aboard by then. Where he'd gotten on was anyone's guess. It could have been all the way back at Rockhampton. The first-class sleeper was connected to the second-class sleeper by a gangway, but other sitting carriages further back didn't have walkways connected to these cars. So the killer could have been a second-class sleeping car passenger who'd moved into car 997 to commit his crime. Anyone further back would have been detected by the conductor or station guards if they'd tried to switch carriages when the train was stopped. But there was another, even harder to trace possibility. That was that the killer might have slipped onto the first class carriage by jumping the Rattler as it slowed to come into a station or as it chugged out slowly from a platform. The police's theory about the sequence of events in the carriage was this. The killer had been thieving from Spearing when he'd woken up. He'd been killed first. Then Costello had been attacked when he turned his head to the aisle to see what was going on. The murderer had hidden in berth 10, sitting on the bed whose linen showed weight had been put on it. When conductor Tom Boyes entered the carriage after Petrie, he'd been hit from behind and then smashed around the head until he was unconscious. Police had found that a basin in the rear vestibule bore traces of blood. They believed the killer had washed himself. He'd also taken Spearing's clothes because his own were bloody. But these stained garments weren't in the carriage. He'd taken them with him, or tossed them, as he'd done with the murder weapon. Spearing's vest, which the killer had left behind, was a crucial clue. The fabric was distinctive, foundation grey with broad and narrow brown stripes, and it could be shown to potential witnesses who might have seen the killer wearing the matching coat and trousers. A police circular was printed describing this suit in detail. The circular also said the killer might be wearing a grey felt hat, that he had two stolen watches, and he might be carrying Spearing's leather attaché case, which bore the initials PMG. This alert was sent to all police stations, post offices, railway and bus stations, and to pawnbrokers. But a description of a suit, an attaché case, and some jewellery wasn't much to go on. Where had he gotten on the train, and where had he gotten off? What weapon had he used to kill the men? These were the questions that needed to be answered for the police investigation to progress. That morning, cars took officers and recruits up the line from Brisbane to Caboolture to search beside the tracks for the weapon and any other evidence that might have been thrown from the train. After Petrie, the train had stopped at several suburban stations. Bald Hills, Northgate, Nundah, Toombul, Eagle Junction, Woolowan, Main Junction and Brunswick Street. Conductor Tom Boyes hadn't been seen at any of these stations, so he'd definitely been attacked before then. If the killer had gotten off at one of these stations, he would have done so in the pre-dawn darkness, making it easier to slip away unseen or unidentifiable. Then again, just as he could have jumped the train to gain access to the first-class carriage, he could also have jumped from the carriage as it slowed down coming into any one of these stations. He might not have been seen by anyone.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
By the afternoon, the city's papers were giving readers every detail they had on the crime that had shocked the city and the state. The Telegraph devoted its front page to the story. Headline, Double Murder on Mail Train. The paper called it the most cold-blooded murder in the history of Queensland. Adding to the sensation, it ran that photo of Harold Spearing's body being taken from the carriage. The Telegraph's competitor, the Daily Standard, went with a multi-deck front page headline that read, Ghastly Mail Train Murder. Two battered to death, conductor's condition critical, Rockhampton mail mystery, crime without a motive, slayer disappears in darkness, police search for maniac. The Daily Standard's reporting spared no detail. Quote, the crime appeared to be the act of a madman. Mr. Spearing's face was so badly chopped about that postal officials had difficulty in identifying him. This intensive newspaper coverage and the radio broadcast saw most of the other passengers from the train come forward. No one had seen or heard anything. Conductor Tom Boyes might be able to tell the police who'd attacked him if he ever regained consciousness. In the absence of any concrete information, rumours swirled. One had it that Frank Costello's involvement in labour disputes on the northern sugarcane fields had resulted in previous murder attempts. Now assassins had gotten him, and they'd killed Harold Spearing and attacked Tom Boyes simply because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Another rumour said the night train had been carrying a big cargo of gold under guard. The men in the sleeping car had been attacked because they'd been mistaken for these security officers. Neither of these stories was true. But one early lead that Thursday morning did cause some excitement. a man from Chermside came forward to say he'd given a couple of old shirts to a couple of hobos who jumped off the train near Bald Hills that morning, and this led to a search for these men before they went to police and cleared themselves. Turned out the hobos were actually a couple of young would-be Henry Lawsons from Tasmania who were living rough in Queensland so they could write about their experiences. The police commissioner cancelled all leave and every available man, along with Aboriginal trackers, was out searching along the railway line. A tyre lever was found near the tracks between Eagle Junction and Woolowan on Thursday afternoon. Newspapers would say it wasn't bloodstained and that a doctor said it couldn't have inflicted the wounds. The first was true, the tyre iron wasn't bloody. But by 3 p.m, Detective Senior Sergeant Dan Mahoney had delivered it to the doctor performing the post-mortems on Spearing and Costello. The tyre lever was about 18 inches long, a solid cylindrical piece of iron flattened at one end. As far as weapons went, this was a deadly combination between a sharp and a blunt object, its edges thin enough to inflict penetrating injuries when they hit bone. What the doctor soon found was that the flat end fit exactly into the fracture depressions on a section of Frank Costello's skull. Police almost certainly had the murder weapon. It had seemed the killer had washed it in the basin before he'd thrown it from the train. Police search efforts now concentrated on the part of the North Pine River where the tyre iron had been found. The idea was the killer might have thrown his clothes or other evidence into the water or onto the riverbanks when the train crossed the bridge. But even as newspaper photographers took pictures of this search scene, bigger breakthroughs were happening elsewhere. What now came was a cascade of clues and connections that had set Queensland's police racing in the opposite direction. Police at Gympie had interviewed the town's railway staff and learned that around 12:45 a.m. on Thursday morning, there'd been a few commercial travellers on the platform. These people already had their tickets for second-class carriages. But just before the overnight train was due in, a man in a grey suit and Panama hat arrived at the station. He was carrying a small parcel and a newspaper, and he sat apart from other people. The night watchman had passed him a few times, and when he did, the fellow seemed to be hiding his face behind his newspaper. When the overnight train came in a few minutes later, conductor Tom Boys was standing on the leading end of the first-class sleeping car. After it stopped, he spoke to the man in the grey suit. Then the fellow went to the ticket office. There, he presented a first-class season travel pass. What he needed was to pay the difference for a sleeping berth. He did, and was issued a ticket in a name that the ticket clerk couldn't remember. But this name would have been on Conductor Boy's diagram of the sleeping berth, which explained why the killer had taken it. Unfortunately, the ticket clerk hadn't gotten a good look at this passenger. Despite the limited information, this revelation was chilling. There'd been a third man on car 997. He'd joined at Gympie and been shown to his berth by Conductor Tom Boys. For hours, he'd lain in wait on the bunk. Then, he'd gone about his thieving, murdering business. Police now knew where the man had joined the train, but where he left it was far more crucial in terms of finding him. Police soon had another breakthrough in this regard. Woolowan's station mistress, Henrietta Roberts, provided vital information. She remembered a man getting off the night train at 10 to 6 in the morning. He hadn't offered his ticket. When she'd asked for one, he'd handed over a ticket marked Ledger. What that meant was it had been requisitioned for a government employee. The man who'd given her the ticket passed beneath the light, so she'd gotten a side-on glimpse of him. He was wearing a grey suit that seemed too big, and he was carrying a leather attaché case. This man had left the station at the Eagle Junction end. Police checked the ticket number and found it had been issued to Harold Spearing at Maryborough. The man the station mistress had seen was almost certainly the murderer. Milkman George Kirby from Chermside came forward with the next piece of the puzzle. He'd been delivering about 500 yards from Woolowan Station at 6 on the morning of the murders. This was just 3.5 miles north of Brisbane Central Station. He'd seen a young man with a leather attaché case come from the direction of the station. This fellow had asked where he might get a taxi. Mr. Kirby had given him directions. Strange and contradictory as it might sound, the Milko said he couldn't remember what the man looked like, but he hadn't been able to take his eyes off him. Mr. Kirby would later say, quote, "He seemed to have a sort of glitter in his eyes. It was something peculiar I cannot explain." Police interviewed taxi men at Woolowan and soon turned up cab driver Leonard Farrell. Mr. Farrell had been at the rank at 6:10 in the morning, about to wash his yellow cab, when a young fellow with an attaché case had walked up. The man wanted to be taken to Grey Street near the South Brisbane Railway Station. The taxi driver would say, quote, "I did not take much notice of how he was dressed, but I saw that his clothes were a bit big for him." Mr. Farrell drove his passenger to the end of the Grey Street Bridge. The fare was 3 and 6. The young man gave him 4 shillings and didn't bother about the change before he walked off. With their search now narrowing, police worked through Thursday night and into the early hours of Friday, interviewing railway workers and taxi drivers at South Brisbane Station. Further pieces rapidly fell into place. Yesterday morning, a man had asked at the office for a rail ticket to Southport. When he was informed the next train wasn't for an hour, he appeared anxious and then walked off. Alan Bourne, commissioned driver of Blue and White Cab 44, told police that around 6:40 the previous morning, he'd been hired at Grey Street. His passenger was a young man with an attaché case. He had a reddish complexion and he wanted to go to Coolangatta. That was some 80 miles. Mr. Bourne told him it was going to cost him more than the train. The man said that was okay, and off they went. When they stopped for petrol at a garage in Holland Park, the passenger asked if it was all right if he sat in the front. Mr. Bourne said sure, but the young man wasn't talkative, other than to ask for a match for his smoke. They got to Coolangatta and the man got out at the Grand Hotel, paying the 4 quid fare with 4 £1 notes. Late yesterday morning, Mr. Bourne had handed in the night's takings to the taxi's owner, James Ward. By 9:30 on Friday morning, police had found Mr. Ward and he'd handed over this cash to them. One of the £1 notes appeared to be bloodstained front and back. By 11 that morning, the note was with the Government Health Department's bacteriologist. He quickly confirmed the blood was human. Taxi driver Mr. Bourne told police he'd definitely be able to identify the passenger if he saw him again. They took him to the CIB. There, he briefly looked at mugshots without identifying any of the rogues as being his passenger. But there was more pressing business than looking at pictures. At 1:30, in the care of detectives Dan Mahoney and Tom Brennelly, the taxi driver was bundled into one of 2 police cars that then sped to Coolangatta. There, police learned the man they were after had yesterday around 9 a.m. walked across the border to Tweed Heads. Alerting New South Wales police to their intentions, the Queensland detectives and the taxi driver went to Tweed Heads. There, they learned that the man they were after had yesterday morning asked a bus driver if he could make it to Marwoolumba in time to catch the Sydney Express at Casino. The Queensland police sped to Marwoolumba. By now, Detective Thomas McRae, New South Wales's top homicide man, was racing up from Sydney to lend assistance. What the police hoped was that the man they were after hadn't made that train to Sydney. But they quickly learned that he had made it in time to get the rail motor down to Casino. And at Casino, Detective McRae spoke to a railway clerk who'd sold a Sydney ticket to a man matching the description of the fugitive. The man they were after had a head start of nearly 24 hours. The train he was apparently on had been due into Sydney at 7:30 that morning. While Detective Brannelly headed back to Brisbane in one of the police cars, Detective Mahoney and another sergeant, along with the taxi driver, raced south for Sydney in the other police car. The roads were reportedly cleared so they could make the 450-mile journey as fast as possible. Radioing ahead to local police, they'd stopped briefly along the way to hand strips they'd cut from Spearing's vest to officers. This was just in case a man was picked up wearing a similar suit. What did police now know about their quarry? While his escape might have seemed cunning, the fact that he'd asked about a train ticket to Southport and then asked about a bus to Marwoolumba showed he was improvising. He'd actually been incredibly lucky to get taxis, buses and trains that had gotten him out of Brisbane and then out of the state and speeding for Sydney. On Saturday morning, 48 hours after the murders, Detective Brannelly flew down from Brisbane to Sydney by special plane. The wireless police car containing Detective Mahoney, the sergeant and Mr. Bourne arrived a little later in the day. Detective McRae was also now back in Sydney and on the case. The best men of the Queensland and the New South Wales police forces stood ready. But there was only so much they could do. Sydney's population then was 1.25 million, and this was more than all of the people in Queensland. In this multitude, they were looking for one man. They didn't have his name or even an alias, let alone a mugshot. Just a taxi driver who'd know him if he saw him. It's not much of a stretch to assume that people on the east coast of Australia taking night trains that weekend felt a little uneasy. After all, there was a double murdering maniac out there somewhere. At around 10 that Saturday night, at Mossvale, 80 miles southwest of Sydney, a young woman named Miss Williams boarded a second-class carriage on the overnight train south to Melbourne. This young lady was about 5'6", slender, with short wavy ginger hair beneath a red straw hat. Miss Williams had hazel eyes and wore spectacles. She had a long bronze face that was smattered with freckles. She wore a grey woolen cardigan jacket, grey frock, brown stockings and black shoes. And she carried a black handbag and a single suitcase as luggage. No doubt other men and women in the carriage were reading that evening's Daily Telegraph. The front page headline, Queensland train murderer sought in Sydney. The police were looking for him there. They weren't looking for her here. People on the train who'd interacted with Miss Williams already knew that she was a he. Why was this man dressed as a woman? One passenger thought it was because he was an undercover policeman. Maybe he was looking for the killer. What they didn't know was that Miss Williams wasn't just any man. Miss Williams was the most wanted man in the country. The most wanted man in the country who was now about to disappear into the metropolis that was Melbourne. I'm Michael Adams, and you've been listening to part one of the three-part Forgotten Australia episode, Nightmare on the Night Train. Parts two and three will be released next week, or you can hear them right now by becoming a Forgotten Australia supporter. Supporter funds go towards research materials to ensure that no stone's left unturned when researching these episodes. For more information, go to patreon.com/Forgotten Australia, and that link's in your show notes. You can also support Forgotten Australia simply by leaving a rating and review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your downloads. I love hearing what you think of episodes, and by leaving a rating and review, you'll also help the show reach more people. Forgotten Australia is written and produced by me in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales on land traditionally owned by the Darug and Gundungurra people. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.